What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. That's Alexander. He just wants attention. Don't give him the satisfaction.
Oh.
That's Douglas. I count on Douglas for everything.
Well,
I was stranded on a desert island. I could only take one thing. Be Douglas. We can share him if you want.
Yeah, it's good. I might need one of those.
This week on the show, Josh and I do go to a desert island, but we're not taking wild things with us. We're taking directors. Directors' filmographies, to be exact.
And we're not sharing.
Fine. But if Maurice Sendak is off the table, what about John McNaughton's Wild Things?
You can have that one.
Thanks.
Desert Island Directors is this week's top five, plus interviews with directors David Gordon Green and Jonathan Glazer. That and more,
I call Kubrick
crap, ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM414.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's great to be back. And after being away from the show for a month, I feel a bit like I've returned from a desert island, Josh, which is exactly where we're headed for this week's top five desert island directors. Five directors' filmographies to distract us from a lifetime of isolation and solitude.
Well, with a volleyball, of course.
I don't know. Don't you remember how that volleyball just left poor Tom Hanks high and dry there at the end?
That's true. He did.
Just ran off.
He did turn on him.
But first, I recently had the chance to sit down with director David Gordon Green and Ty Sheridan, one of the stars of Green's new film, Joe. For a young actor with only three release films under his belt, Sheridan has a pretty formidable track record following his debut in Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. Green started his career with the critically acclaimed indies George Washington and All the Real Girls before taking on bigger budget mainstream comedies, including The Sitter and Your Highness.
A return to smaller, darker work that fans of his earlier stuff had been hoping for started last year with the excellent Prince Avalanche with Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch. His latest, Joe, was shot in the same patch of Texas woods as Avalanche, minus the forest fire damage and surreal comedy. Joe is, in Green's words, a contemporary Western, with Nicolas Cage as a reformed outlaw who befriends a teenager named Gary, played by Sheridan, who drifts from town to town with his alcoholic father and helpless mother and sister. The movie is an adaptation of a 2003 Larry Brown novel. Back in film school, Green worked on a documentary about the Mississippi writer, known for his gritty Southern Gothic style, called The Rough South of Larry Brown.
The doc was directed by Gary Hawkins, who was one of Green's instructors at film school, and it was Hawkins who wrote Joe's screenplay adaptation. I started by asking Green if all those connections from his past coming together for this project was serendipity, or did he always envision doing something with Brown's work?
Well, I think it's all full circle. You know, my first job out of film school was, as you say, working as a production assistant on The Rough South of Larry Brown. So he's a writer that I got to know personally and then got to know his literature. The first time I read the novel Joe, I just fell in love with it and really visualized the cinematic qualities of it, as I always am kind of picturing the movie version of a novel when I'm reading it. And so when Larry passed away and Gary brought me this adaptation he'd done of Joe, I was more than intrigued. I was excited and I was enlightened as I was introduced to what his adaptation of the novel was, and got really excited about bringing it to life. That's kind of the joy of what I get to do, is find these seeds of ideas or inspirations, and sometimes they come from my own imagination, sometimes they come from a brilliant writer like Larry.
One of my favorite scenes in cinema all of last year was that dreamy sequence in your previous film, Prince Avalanche, with Paul Rudd and the lady walking among the ruins of that house. And there just seemed to me this real specter of domesticity haunting that scene and haunting that whole film and other works of yours. But this film as well, there seems to be this fear on the part of the main characters, at least an incapability of being that kind of man slash father slash husband. Where does the interest in that topic come from for you?
Well, I think a lot of film directors, a lot of storytellers and writers, screenwriters and novelists look to some pretty broad concepts, things that they know sell books, that sell movie tickets. I think I'm really drawn to internal stories of someone that's struggling with themselves, or two characters that have an intimate issue that they're struggling to deal with. Prince Avalanche was very much a story of two characters against a strange environment and the kind of surreal, ghostly qualities that inhabited that environment. Joe takes that a step further. We were filming on the other side of the highway from the forest fire where Avalanche took place, and we're filming in an area where the trees are fully strong and healthy, and this is a movie about men poisoning these trees, mm-hmm. cutting these trees down, and that became a very haunting and poetic backdrop to illustrate Cage's internal dilemmas and internal struggles.
Mm-hmm. Ty, along those lines, your three films so far that have come out, Tree of Life and Mud and now Joe, they're fundamentally about family. Sometimes we see the beauty in that, sometimes the sorrow in those relationships, oftentimes both. In Mud and Joe, of course, we also have real fathers and surrogate fathers. Is that material you're consciously drawn to or just naturally drawn to? Or are you making a choice to seek out that kind of material?
Yeah, fathers and sons stories is something that I've always been drawn to, and I find very interesting because I find the relationship between my father and myself very interesting. And I found something very interesting in this character that I didn't see in myself. His father is very abusive and alcoholic. And, you know, I've always had that strong structural father figure in my life. And it was something that he didn't have, which drew me to the character.
I'm guessing, like a lot of actors, you're interested in playing parts that maybe are different than yourself and
trying some
different emotions and some different parts of life.
Yeah, giving yourself a challenge as an actor is always good. It's a good exercise, but because, you know, I've never wanted to be the type of actor that gets typecasted and doing the same role over and over and over again. And I know, you know, my past three films have all three been Southern dramas, so, you know, the characters all relatively been kind of the same, but not exactly. But in these, you know, I've got a couple movies that are coming out or are in post-production right now that the characters are very different, so I'm excited to see. Mm.
David, there is that tension in this film, certainly, between that notion of domesticity and its opposite, this impulse for violence and destruction. And it's almost welcome, I found, when it finally erupts. There's violence throughout, but when it finally erupts in this really almost operatic scene, I felt that the whole film, these characters, at least the Joe character played by Nicolas Cage, is so repressed that I did find myself almost wanting that eruption, if that makes any sense at all. How did you approach that?
Well, the movie's about restraint. Ultimately, we were trying to make a contemporary Western, something that fit within that genre, that had redemptive qualities, characters that were outlaws or seen culturally as outlaws, struggling with the morality of some of the more unsavory characters that are inhabiting where they live. And talking to Cage, and when you bring the notion of Nicolas Cage into a movie, you bring a lot of perception, preconceptions of what that means. I really focused on making this the movie that Nicolas Cage had never made before. He's made so many movies, from huge comedic films to Oscar-winning dramatic films and Hollywood blockbuster action adventure movies. I wanted this to be a movie about restraint. You take a character that we know is set to boil, set to pop, set to explode, and what happens when he's holding back, and what happens when his arms are tied and his ethics are keeping him from doing what, you know, he feels like he should do. And there's a lot of the kind of moral and mythological questioning that goes into this, just as you would if we were entertaining the notion of a Western.
Hey, mister.
Yeah?
I got a question for you. You see, me and my daddy just got into town. I was wondering if you'd give us a job. We're looking for work.
How old are you?
15.
Well, you got 45 seconds to tell me why I should hire you.
I built hay before. I worked on a truck. I picked tomatoes, zucchini, cucumbers, okra, squash.
All right, you're not afraid of work. Good. What's your name?
Gary Jones.
I'm Joe. I pay a day's pay for a day's work. I pay on Fridays, so you get a little something today.
Okay.
But your first real payday is next Friday. We start about 6 in the morning, quit at 1 or 2. And if we work till dinner and get rained out, I pay for the whole day. Does that sound fair enough?
Yes, sir.
I definitely want to talk about Cage in some more detail, but following this idea of violence and how you explore it, the movie definitely does seem to wrestle with an idea that's been wrestled with in a lot of literature and a lot of cinema for as long as we can remember, about violence being a vicious, damaging cycle. And at the same time, without giving anything away, there's also the idea that it's cathartic, or can be a little bit cathartic. There's that fine line. How did you walk that fine line and that dichotomy?
Well, that's what we're exploring here, I think, is the catharsis, is the redemption, is a man using violence for a noble cause, if there could be such a thing. Holding back as long as he can, and then understanding when he needs to step in front of a gun in the situation at hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an exploration of masculinity, an exploration of how culturally we see violence in this day and age, and also the kind of timeless qualities of it, how throughout the ages men have taken the easy way out oftentimes, and the absurdity of violence. And those are all things that I find fascinating.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with director David Gordon Green. His new film is Joe. It stars Ty Sheridan. Ty, I want to ask you a little bit about Cage and just acting with some of the other people you acted with on this film. The three main characters, you had this real wide range of acting experience. On one end, you have Nicolas Cage, this veteran actor, 74 IMDb credits, at least what I saw today. On the other end, Gary Poulter, who we're going to talk about a little bit more here in a bit, his first and last tragically screen role. And then you, somewhere sort of in the middle with those three films and a few more coming out, as you said, in post-production. Was that range of experience something that you were aware of at all while shooting? And what did you take away from working with those two actors and those two actors of that range of experience?
It was fun. You know, it's very interesting. I thought the balance of the cast was really cool because we had, you know, several non-actors and people that had no acting experience whatsoever until this film. And then you've got Nicolas Cage, who's been in, you know, so many films, mm-hmm. and then me, who I've, you know, I've been in a couple. I've had a little acting experience, but you know, enough to know what I'm doing. So, you know, it's fun. I think it's always fun working with non-actors because it kind of keeps you on your toes, because, you know, they get kind of nervous sometimes and stuff just comes out of their mouth, and most of the time it's really great stuff and you just have to roll with it.
Yeah. How was your collaboration with Nicolas Cage specifically? Because I'm thinking that in some ways, if Joe is arguably or potentially a future version of Gary, Nicolas Cage in some ways could be a future version of you, right? He is an older actor and you're a young actor and he's mentoring you or could be mentoring you on screen and off. Was it important for you guys to have a bond and develop some chemistry away from your scenes?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think if the chemistry doesn't work in this movie between Joe and Gary, then the movie doesn't work itself. But yeah, you know, I remember going to read with Nick. And the first time I met him, I remember I shook his hand and he said, "My name's Nick." And of course I knew who Nicolas Cage was, but I thought
right.
It was just really cool that, you know, when he introduced himself, he said he introduced himself as Nick.
Uh-huh.
So that was, you know, I had a great first impression of him. And then I remember reading with him for the first time, felt really good. And yeah, we had a blast.
David, you talked about our relationship to Nicolas Cage as an audience member, and I want to ask you specifically about that because we're the same age. So I would have been about 8 to 10 years old when movies like Raising Arizona came out and Peggy Sue Got Married. These are films I was obsessed with and watched all the time, and I was a huge Nicolas Cage fan. I loved the bold choices he made, you know, and there were cartoonish elements sometimes too that maybe that appealed to me in those comedies as a young man. But even that nasal thing he does with the character in Peggy Sue Got Married, those kind of affectations are things that I don't think a lot of actors could really pull off. And at the same time, there is something grounded and dramatic and real in all those characters. And I'm really curious, mostly, what your relationship to Nicolas Cage was growing up as viewer watching his movies.
I was always a huge fan of the risks he took, from eating a cockroach in Vampire's Kiss to the wild off the wall character in Moonstruck. And I remember being haunted by Wild at Heart, which I snuck into probably at too young an age. but the beauty of him is just his dedication to being him. He's a fearless actor. He's a fearless artist. If you spend any amount of time with him, people recognize him and come up to him and acknowledge various films as their favorite movies. And you'd be amazed how many, like at a biker bar, a guy comes up to me, comes up to Cage and is like, "Hey man, I just wanted you to know how much that movie, Captain Corelli's Mandolin, means to me." You know, and just like, okay, I love that. And
it's great.
In the diversity, you can't pinpoint what people love about him. It's just this kind of, it's like an incredible charisma that he has, and he brings that every day in that dedication to work. And I think that full body of experience and interest, curiosity that he has, is it infects the cast and the crew. And we did have the joy of working with a lot of non-traditional actors in this movie that I feel like we're put at ease because he always has a good smile and a good story and a hand on their shoulder as he's taking them under wing and we're walking into some wild uncertainty. That was kind of the beauty. You would have an actor of that experience, a young discovery like Ty, just beginning a very fruitful career, and these guys that we would cast from bus stops or day labor centers or working at barbecue restaurants around in and around Austin, Texas, where we filmed.
He's a great actor, so I'm guessing you didn't have to work too hard on this with him. But you talked about how the movie's about restraint, and we see a lot of that, of course, in Joe's character. I mean, he really is repressing that and trying to show that restraint at all times. Nicolas Cage does have a reputation as a sort of manic actor. We see that in a lot of his roles. Was that something that you had to work with him on, or you guys had to talk about it all in terms of really sublimating that energy?
I think that's what drew him to the role. I think what drew him to the role is the opportunity to not have to act so much. He says Joe is the most like him of any character he's ever played. And I really, getting to know Nick, I believe that. It is a character of pause, because his instinct in which he might behave could be of question culturally. And I think he's such a good-hearted, big-hearted, sensitive individual that he's got a lot on his hands when he realizes that everyone recognizes him as he walks around.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a baggage that he's got to bear every day on the sidewalk that you and I don't necessarily have to face.
I read that he did come to you with a lot of ideas and was pretty intimately involved in a lot of the process. Is that something you welcome as a director with your actors?
I love the improvisational process. I love Gary Hawkins did a wonderful adaptation for us, and we had a great blueprint to play with. And then I love to mess around and bring the actors' ideas and instincts. We had a lot of just voices from a level of authenticity of the cast that I was equally as interested in what they thought, what they say, as I was what the design of the screenplay was.
Hmm. Ty, that's a perfect transition. I wanted to ask you about that improvisation and how much there was of that for you and how comfortable you were with that. As we talked about, young actor here, and you're working with some people who have even less experience than you, but others like Nicolas Cage who have a lot more. So was that something that you found daunting, or something you were able to just throw yourself into as the character?
Yeah, I love improvisation, and I love that David's okay with doing it, you know, because a lot of directors aren't. You know, they like to stick to, you know, what they have, what their materials are in their script and you know, some of their ideas. But it's nice when you can incorporate. It's a collaboration of everyone's ideas, mm-hmm. and like what they think would be best or what might be interesting for the scene. So, you know, I love improvisation. On the first film that I ever did, I didn't read a script. And so everything I had as far as dialogue was either something that I had come up with, so it was improvised, or it was either right there on the spot when the director told me to say mm-hmm. it while we were shooting.
Right. That so director being Terrence Malick, of course.
Exactly, yeah. So it was something I was very familiar with. And it was nice to do the Malick film where I had, you know, a lot of improvisation and things thrown at me. And then I went to the Jeff Nichols film where it was strictly dialogue from the script. And then I worked with David, and it was kind of like the improvisation feel again.
Yeah. We talked a lot here so far about casting non-actors. I want to get specifically into that topic, because this actor who plays Wade, Ty's father in the movie, Gary Poulter, I usually feel like I have a pretty good sense when I'm watching a film where I'm seeing quote-unquote non-professional actors. There's a certain naturalness to their performance. Sometimes it comes off as awkwardness. Sometimes that's a good thing or a bad thing when they're on camera. But on the same episode, we're playing my interview with Jonathan Glazer in his new film, Under the Skin, coming out the same weekend as yours here in Chicago. He cast a lot of non-professionals in that film, and often it's very obvious. You can tell some of the scenes. But I found later there were a bunch of scenes that I was sure were very natural and very well done, but had to be scripted and had to be using actors, even though they weren't actors I recognize. Come to find out, totally improvised, non-actors. They didn't even know they were on camera. So my radar there was completely off. And then the same thing here with Joe. I was sure watching Wade on screen that he was some actor that had that talent, who just had that magical ability to appear authentically like a drifter you just picked up off the street and put in this role, but was clearly some Juilliard-trained actor I had just never seen before on screen. And it turns out I was wrong again. How did you luck out in casting Gary?
I have a very adventuresome casting director that I work with. John Williams and Carmen Leach actually worked together and pounded the pavement literally to find fresh voices, faces that had that charisma but didn't have the Hollywood polish. The Wade Jones character is one that I find is an iconic villain of contemporary Southern literature. It is, if you read the novel Joe, it is just mind-blowing, the brutality capable of this man. And wanting to find someone that had a look in their eye that wasn't necessarily traditionally trained or engineered, but came from a place of hardship and hard living and weather. We met Gary Poulter at a bus stop in Austin, Texas, downtown, and going from who knows where to who knows where, and brought him in to read a role. There's a scene of a guy cutting up a deer after a deer hunt, and Brought him in to read for a role that would be a one-day role, and he was great. And I said, okay, well, that's easy. Why don't you come back in and read the two-day role of the guy that runs the convenience store? Came back in and knocked it out of the park, and I said, man, you got something really special about you. Why don't you take a script, read the script, see what you think, come back for the third lead in the movie? And so he came back a few days later and just blew us away. And we all look at it, I say we all, the producers, the casting directors, Nicolas Cage, everybody involved look at it as just, he was waiting for us and really brought such a degree of professionalism and work ethic, focus and opportunity to this role. And it was an incredible experience working with Gary Poulter. He passed away shortly after the production. And the last thing he ever said to me was like, if I die tomorrow, I'll die a happy man, which is an interesting thing to say. But in his last few weeks of life, he was treated like a king on the set, and he brought so much joy, humor, and hope to our movie set that it's just it's kind of incredible that it exists, you know, that we were lucky enough to meet him, find him, and have him be a part of our project.
Come on, get up. Come on, please. You'll be all right. Come on, I'll help you up. You can make it.
Yeah, no, you know what? I'm gonna sit right here in the dirt. I'm gonna teach you a little about breakdancing. You ever see breakdancing before? You know what popping, you know what locking is on, do you, bud? You ever see this hand right here? Pretend it's going over a wave like you're out there in the ocean. You floating, come on, sir, you floating down the ocean. Whoa, tidal wave coming across the body to the other side. Here we go, oh yeah, we're waving now. Bring it back up, here comes the big one, how, yeah.
Were there films along the way in your education or just growing up that you watched that influenced you in wanting to take some challenges like that in terms of casting non-actors that showed you that that was something that could be done and could work?
Absolutely. I'm very drawn to the films of Werner Herzog, which is actually where I met Nicolas Cage for the first time on the set of Bad Lieutenant. And I just find, I guess I was probably in high school the first time I saw Strozik. One of his films starred a man named Bruno S. Mm-hmm. And any number of his films from Kasper Hauser and so on and so forth. Just always eclectic, risk-taking, challenging casting that found this unpredictable quality to be able to take the narrative into places that, that I always found refreshing. And if only I could emulate that to some small degree, certainly gives me the gumption to try to take such a risk.
I really love the opening of the film. Very stylized in a way, but very simple. And I want to ask you both about it, but Ty, I'll start with you. The way the movie opens with that accusation, almost your father's on trial, you're accusing him of his bad behavior and telling him how it's going to be, sort of trying to lay down the law with your father. And the way David chose to shoot that in terms of having the camera behind you the whole time and we just see his face and hear your voice, I'm wondering how you approached that scene and how you guys collaborated on it.
Yeah, well, it was an idea that David desperately wanted to have in the film. And I remember during pre-production, during rehearsal, we recorded that huge monologue. And so I'm thinking, you know, this is already recorded. I don't have to worry about this scene anymore. And so, like, it comes to when we were going to shoot it. And he said, oh, you know what, Ty? I'm seeing your mouth a little bit. I'm going to need you to do the monologue. And I'm like, oh, no, I didn't prepare this. And so I, you know, I did it the best I could and improvised a little bit and just the best to my memory. And he ended up using that recording in the actual final
cut.
He
used the take you did live.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I was, you know, and he told me about it, and I was kind of worried about it, but I didn't want him to know, which I think it turned out okay. But yeah, it was great. And then along the way, in the middle of when we were shooting, David had this idea for the end of the movie because he wanted it to be relevant to the beginning. And so it's over the farmer's shoulder on me. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, you see it's over my shoulder, right. My dad, and he hits me. And so, he sticks his hand out, and the farmer gets up. And so it kind of shows you that, you know, he did take the right path.
Right. And I want to ask you about that strike, because I think there seems to be a clear parallel in something you were deliberately trying to do, David, in terms of the way that scene ends when Wade does strike his son, and he strikes him in a way that's mirrored just a short time later as he walks up the hill and he's met by some men who are seeking some kind of retribution from him. We see a few more instances of that throughout the movie, but right away you seem to be setting the table for this sort of eye for an eye notion of justice that the whole movie deals with.
Yeah, again, I wanted to set the tone right out of the gate for the type of genre, the type of material we're dealing with. And then And then let humor and hope and humanity be the opportunity that we start to uncover through the movie. It's not a movie that we wanted to construct to be dark or bleak. We wanted it to deal with difficult subject matter, approach drama with authenticity and naturalism, and really find the humanity in it. And a lot of what I think I've been really inspired by in terms of the audience reaction to the movie is that people do get the humor, and there's a lot of improvised moments, just connections between Nicolas Cage's character and Ty's character, and some of the eccentric supporting cast that we also have that really bring a lightness to it and a life that injects and invites all of us to enjoy the narrative here.
You talked about when casting non-actors, looking for those kind of challenges and being bold in some of your choices. One of the things I also talked to Jonathan Glazer about was that desire on his projects to find some kind of new challenge. And Under the Skin is shot in a very specific, stylized way, but it was a way that best served the story. It's not necessarily something he was trying to do for every film in the future. It just worked on this film. Are you seeking out with every project something new like that, whether it's thematic, whether it's something formal, something you haven't tried before?
Always. I think the greatest thing about this industry for me is that it's a passport to the world, and I get to travel. I get to show up here in Chicago and hang out and try new foods and meet new people, and every day is a new opportunity for exploration. I think from my work, comedic work in the movies is studio-driven as Pineapple Express or TV shows like Eastbound and Down or movies that deal with dramatic, difficult subject matter like George Washington's Snow Angels or this kind of falls into line with mm-hmm. those previous stories that I've been a part of, and then look into the future where I could do, you know, the next Bollywood musical or a great documentary. I'd like to see that. Or a crappy documentary. Who knows?
And Ty, I wanted to ask you a few more questions about acting, but before that, I need to sort of set up for myself and for the audience. You talked about working on Tree of Life with Terrence Malick. How did you come about getting cast in The Tree of Life?
Yeah, well, I just kind of fell into that movie. They auditioned like 10,000 kids in the state of Texas, and I was one of the three boys that got casted. They sent out a group of casting directors to a lot of the schools in Texas, and they came to my school, and they were recruiting kids. And, you know, I got a letter in the mail to come to an audition. And I ended up going to 10 or 11 auditions. And that's a lot. So it's like, it was like 10 or 11 callbacks. And this was like a year-long process from my first audition to the point when I got casted in the movie. It was like a year-long process. So, you know, it was almost like, you know, I didn't believe that this was actually going to happen. I was going to be cast in a movie. I thought it was, you know, it had been stretched out for so long that I didn't feel like it was true. And then, so I get cast in the movie, and then I go and I find out that Brad Pitt's going to be the father. And I didn't know who Brad Pitt was.
Really?
Really. And so I was like, oh, no big deal. That guy's got a weird last name. So, you know, and then I did the film, and I had so much fun because, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like I love improvisation and everything was improvised, and it was like a 4-month long process that we were shooting, and I was hanging out with these kids and Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain, and it was a fun summer. And then it got like the whole world was, it was just taken away from me.
Yeah.
And then it was like I got the acting bug, like I wanted to do it again.
Wow. Today in prepping for this interview was watching some scenes from The Tree of Life, and I swear I saw you in one of those scenes, one of those montages, chasing Jessica Chastain around with a lizard. Wasn't that you in that scene?
Absolutely.
It made me think of the snake scene early on in Joe, actually, and your fascination there and his picking that up. So now that you've got the acting bug and you're doing, obviously, a lot more movies, do you do any homework, not just preparing for your character, but, for example, when you are looking at doing a David Gordon Green film, do you watch other David Gordon Green films?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I used to think, and don't hate me for saying this, David, but I used to think
truth
that
comes out.
If you had a good script and you had a good cast, then it was going to be perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the director didn't have much to do with it.
Said action, said cut.
He was just there to say, you know, action, cut, and just kind of supervise, but it was mainly the material and the story you had and the cast. But I was totally wrong.
Well, you've worked with three pretty amazing directors so far.
Yeah, and it was just like
seen.
I thought that every director was great.
Yeah.
And so I did a film this summer, and the script was really good, and I thought we got a good cast, and it just kind of fell apart. And that's when I realized that, like, man, I need to do my homework before I sign on to do a movie. Because, you know, everybody's know David Gordon Green or Terrence Malick or Jeff Nichols.
I believe, am I right, that you're 17 now and in 15 when you were shooting this film? So you've mentioned now all these directors, and they are formidable people. Jeff Nichols, obviously, the fewest films to his credit so far, but they're all guys with very specific visions. What What do you take from them other than knowing that you need to do your homework? What have you learned sort of from working with those three?
Well, I think it's great, you know, being able to work with them and you know, look at some of their styles. And also what's really cool is being on set and watching how the process is done and how shots are set up and then seeing it in the final cut.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, maybe I see myself directing someday too. So, you know, while I'm working with these directors, I definitely need to be taking notes.
I'm curious, Ty, how you look to continue to develop as an actor. You mentioned maybe wanting to direct someday, but is your focus right now on expanding your knowledge of film, taking in more cinema? Is it on getting better at acting, focusing on the craft of acting, or is it more on just growing up and learning more about life and expanding your knowledge that way? Or is it, I'm guessing, a combination of all of those?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. You know, I want to become, you know, as smart as I can be. And, you know, right now I see myself and it's like, you know, I may be average or a little below the average teenager, but I definitely want to continue to, for my knowledge, to grow and watch films and grow in that category. Because I feel like you have to have, as an actor, you have to have knowledge and experience to incorporate in your characters.
Mm-hmm. David Gordon Green, Ty Sheridan, best of luck with this movie. I enjoy your work in this movie and in previous films. Look forward to seeing more. Thanks for your time.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to David Gordon Green and Ty Sheridan. You know, Josh, it's funny. I talked about my love for Nicolas Cage there in that interview when I was a kid. I go for the comedies like Peggy Sue Got Married and Raising Arizona. Where does David Gordon Green go? Movies like Vampire's Kiss and Wild at Heart. I think you mentioned Moonstruck as well. Maybe even though we were the same age, David Gordon Green was just a little deeper into cinema than I was.
A little different sensibility already, perhaps.
I guess so.
Yeah.
You know, I also thought about the fact as I was re-listening to the interview that I mentioned in there when I was talking to Ty Sheridan specifically that Mud, his previous film, The Jeff Nichols, was a movie that featured a surrogate father like Joe does. But I'm not sure that's probably accurate. I don't really think that Matthew McConaughey's character, the titular figure there in Mud, is much of a father figure. He's more like the dangerous uncle.
Yeah, uncle, older brother type mm-hmm. thing. But there are certainly father issues
yes.
in Mud at play here, and that comes to the fore in Joe, which we'll get into when we do get to our review. I'm glad he spent some time talking about Gary Poulter, though, who plays Ty Sheridan's character's actual father in Joe, because that was the performance that just blew me away mm-hmm. from the film. And going into it, I had no idea that he was a non-professional. And hearing that afterwards somehow made it even more impressive. Sometimes we get that where we
right.
don't know that they're non-professionals and you find out about it later. And we'll definitely spend some time talking about that performance, I'm sure.
He's so good in it. It inspired our top five for next
right.
week, which
yep.
we haven't done before here on the show. Top five performances by non-professional actors. So look forward to that. And look forward to Joe, which opens in Chicago and is out in limited release now. It's also available via video on demand. We are going to spend a little bit more time on Joe. We're planning to discuss it next week on the show.
Adam and I are going to get in the cage next for Massacre Theater. Unfortunately, not with Nick Cage, though, just each other. Then we'll share Adam's interview with Jonathan Glazer, director of the acclaimed new film Under the Skin. Stay with us. Quick interruption here as we pause to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you can find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's a website, an advertisement, or a multimedia presentation, or any other type of film project. You can choose from over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most do come in HD and now 4K.
And inspired by our topics this week and my conversation coming up here with Jonathan Glazer, I went to Shutterstock.com and typed in skin.
Sounds dangerous.
A little bit. Maybe not surprising, it returned over 15,000 video clips, and none of them were too racy, Josh, at all. I typed in aliens, again, thinking about Under the Skin, almost 3,000 results there on Shutterstock. Alas, for Scarlett Johansson, zero.
You're kidding me.
No, I guess they're not big into the celebrity photos on Shutterstock.
You probably have to go to more illicit sources for something like
might,
that, is my guess.
You might have to. Shutterstock does source their video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers, and they offer you flexible pricing so you can choose between individual clips or video packs. You can download clips in HD or save with standard definition or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save your video selections that you do find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM414 and new accounts will receive 20% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off new accounts, use offer code FILM414. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
BBC. Allied forces in Singapore have surrendered to the Japanese.
When we surrendered, the Japs said we weren't men. Real men would die of shame.
You have no honor.
You're here to help us.
To build a railway.
If you help, you will have a good war.
But we said no. We'll live to fight you. We'll live for revenge.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. A little bit of the trailer there for The Railway Man, which opens in limited release this weekend and here in Chicago the following weekend. That's April 18th. It's based on a true story starring Colin Firth as a former British Army officer who is still haunted by the time he spent in a Japanese prison camp during World War II. The film co-stars Nicole Kidman and Stellan Skarsgård, and we are giving away some passes to an advanced screening of the movie that's going to be held on Tuesday, April 15th at the Showplace Icon Theater here in Chicago. So for our listeners who are near the city or in the city, if you are interested in going to that screening for free before the movie comes out, here's how you do it. You enter at gofobo.com, G-O-F-O-B-O.com, and you enter the RSVP code FILM. SP1SGT. And if that sounds like a mouthful, it is. We will put that code and the direct link to GoFobo in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
I really hope Skarsgård's wearing more clothes in this than he was in Nymphomaniac. That would just throw this project way off, I think, if they went that direction.
I think that's probably safe to say. And now, Josh, we turn from some high-quality actors there, a couple of them, I'm pretty sure, Oscar-anointed in Kidman and Colin Firth. We're going to go to some truly terrible acting with Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, guest host Michael Phillips and I massacred this scene.
Mr. Allnut.
Yes, miss?
What did you say is in these boxes with the red lines on them?
Well, them? Well, that's blasting gelatin, miss.
Is it dangerous?
Oh, bless you, no, miss. That's safety stuff, that is. You can get it wet and it don't do it any harm. You set fire to it and it just burns. You can hit it with a hammer and it won't go off. At least I don't think it will. It takes a detonator to set it off. I'll put it over the side, though, if it worries you.
No, we may want it. Mr. Allnut.
That was Katharine Hepburn as Rose Sayer and Humphrey Bogart as Charlie Allnut in The African Queen from 1951. It was written by James A.G. and John Huston and directed by Huston.
Back on Film Spotting episode 483, Josh and Michael reviewed Darren Aronofsky's Noah and shared their top five movie boats. If you want to seek out that episode, you can find it on iTunes or at filmspotting.net. And in our feedback this week to Massacre Theater, Josh, I love that we've got a real international flavor. We start with Marcel in Zurich. He says, I am a new listener and I'm already hooked to your show. Now I'm writing in for the first time as I could not believe you failed to mention the best movie boat of all time. Yes, she's not as luxurious and big as the Titanic. Her boiler may be leaking, but she keeps you safe from crocodiles and waterfalls, and she serves as a great stage for a boorish, gin-swilling captain and an uptight missionary to quarrel and fall in love. I am, of course, speaking of the African Queen. She would be my number one movie boat. Kind regards from Switzerland. So many listeners did miss out on the fact that the African Queen, not included on either top five list of movie boats, but was part of Massacre Theater. So it probably would have been excluded anyway, but it's also excluded for another reason. Josh, why don't you share that again with our listeners?
Well, first of all, I find it hard to believe they love the movie that much if they didn't even recognize it in Massacre Theater.
Maybe that the acting was just that bad.
There's always that chance too. I recently watched African Queen, mm-hmm. and I just never bought for a second that central relationship, and that's all the movie is about between Bogart and Hepburn. They were just grating against each other, and not in ways they're supposed to. You know, it's supposed to be this oil and water thing, and they come and fall with each other. Never bought them even as abrasive antagonists.
Yeah.
And it just showcased the worst aspects of both actors, I think, both of whom are obviously among the best, but this vehicle did not service them at all. You've got Bogart making these awful animal impressions and Hepburn forcing a laugh in response that you never buy. And they give probably what is one of the all-time worst movie kisses, where like the faces are just kind of mashed together.
Hey, it was the 50s.
It hurts to watch.
50s.
Oh, come on.
You wanted eroticism?
The movies have been managing better kisses for decades before this. Sorry, African Queen, way overrated.
So I just saw the African Queen myself a couple of years ago.
You're with me. You're
no,
with me.
No, I had no problem with it whatsoever. I had a blast with the African Queen. But it's funny, to digress for a second, you talk about Bogart and that central relationship could be for completely different reasons. At least in this movie, they're roughly the same age. I taught the film Sabrina, the Billy Wilder movie, in one of my classes at the University of Chicago's Graham School. It was a course on Billy Wilder, and we watched Sabrina with a class full of students of all ages, from 24 up to 74, probably. And just about everybody in the room had a problem, many of them watching it for the second time, seeing Humphrey Bogart seducing or trying to be amorous in any way with Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah,
it just didn't work at all. And I do think Sabrina, while it has its moments, it has a lot of great moments. In fact, I do think it's so-called minor Wilder. And that's probably a reason why.
Probably minor Wilder. I'd still take it over African Queen.
Well, we often get great feedback to Massacre Theater in terms of people coming up with connections that we rarely come up with ourselves. And I'm just going to say right now, this is great, first of all, that we got an email from Anthony. I know we're probably going to butcher this, but Tbilisi, Georgia. Oh, of course. You know it. Now all of a sudden you're the expert on geography and pronunciation.
I'm completely making that up. Yet hoping that I'm right.
I'm not going to trust you at all. But this is Georgia, not Georgia the state, Georgia the country that Anthony emails us from. And he really did his homework if he came up with all of these connections.
African Queen is similar to Noah, as the boat is on a mission from God to escape and destroy a big warship. John Huston not only directed the 1966 film The Bible in the beginning, he also played Noah in it.
How about that?
He also directed Moby Dick, Pequod Baby. Katharine Hepburn won a Best Actress Oscar for On Golden Pond, which features a rowboat. C.S. Forrester wrote the novel The African Queen. He also wrote the Horatio Hornblower series, which could be viewed as a necessary precursor to the Patrick O'Brien Captain Aubrey novels, one of which was turned into the Michael Phillips top five boat film, Master and Commander, starring Noah himself.
Noah, Russell Crowe.
Wow.
Wow.
That's creepy.
Anthony, I think we need to hire you as a freelance researcher for the show. That's some amazing work. Thank you to everyone who entered and for the great feedback. Let's go ahead and reach into the film spotting hat, not too brimming, Josh, despite 2 weeks to enter, and pick out this week's winner of the film spotting t-shirt.
That is Dave Bjorling from Moreno Valley, California.
Congratulations, Dave, longtime listener of the show. Just email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your shirt.
Because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the campers.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. What a Massacre Theater to come back to, Josh. A scene now we're going to act out that would probably have been more appropriate for last week's show where you discussed Nymphomaniac.
Yes, that's probably true. Although the prop, for lack of a better word, that's mentioned this scene, I don't know if that makes an appearance in Nymphomaniac, but at that point, you know, my eyes had started to glaze over. It very well could have.
So I think this is where we give out the earmuffs alert.
Yes.
If you are
good idea.
A parent and you're listening in the car or in the kitchen as you make breakfast or do whatever, and there are children in earshot that you don't want to hear the scene, it's actually not a case where the language is that bad. We're just like the MPAA. We can handle violence. We just can't handle suggestiveness,
anything
sexual. So, you know, we're going to try to make this as family friendly as possible while also maintaining the integrity of the scene. It may get bleeped for radio here.
I don't think the scene has any integrity.
I don't know. It's pretty brilliant. It's pretty brilliant. So with that, you're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
All right, let's go.
And action.
Man, I'm just into Buddhism, and I'm at peace with the fact that me, as this person, probably not going to be around. Think about a hermit crab, okay? And it's a shell. It's like they go from one shell to the next, and that's what I am. It's like I'm just a hermit crab changing shells.
Except if you're a dick your whole life, your next shell will be made of shit, okay? If you're an asshole, you're going to come back as a cockroach, or a worm, or a fucking anal bead, okay? If you're a man and you act heroic, you'll come back as an eagle. You'll come back as a dragon. You'll come back as Jude Law, okay? Which would you rather be?
Maybe the anal bead, depending on who it belongs to.
Belongs to me.
Then the dragon.
And
scene. I don't think I nailed that one.
You did really better than I did.
Well,
at least you attempted a voice. Email the movie's title along with the name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net if you were able to identify it. Your deadline is Monday, April 21st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Sir, I'm afraid you can't smoke.
What do you want?
Your cigarette. You have to put it out.
Cigarette? What? This? No, I'm not going to put it out.
You must.
What's that?
If you don't, we can't take off.
Well, that's your problem, isn't it? It's your move.
The first time we encountered the name Jonathan Glazer, it was as director of 2000's Sexy Beast, featuring that very memorable turn. I think my all-time number one screen villain, Ben Kingsley, as Don Logan.
Good pick.
Yeah, Glazer's follow-up in 2004, Birth, starred Nicole Kidman. It got less attention, though it certainly has its admirers, and having just caught up with the film for the first time myself, I'd count myself among them. But his latest film, Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, has received almost unanimous praise since screening at the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals last fall. In the film, Johansson plays a woman stalking Scotland, seducing and killing random men. Also, she's an alien. Here's my conversation with Glazer about Under the Skin, which is out now in Chicago and select cities. Jonathan, the film, very much on the surface, hard to not call it a science fiction film. But I think part of what makes it so fascinating is the way you seem to have stripped away all of the science fiction. It's not really about the details of this alien creature or where it comes from or what its objective is. It really is about the most fundamental aspect of any alien-human encounter or experience, if we were to have one, which is how this alien perceives the world. Was that for you really the challenge, what stimulated you about this film?
Yeah, it was definitely that was the spark for me. The character telling a story through this brand new lens, really. An alien on Earth looking at things for the first time. And then as a filmmaker, the challenge and opportunity for us of having to show that, you know, mm-hmm. express that somehow, and, you know, thinking about things, re-seeing the world, I suppose.
I think what was fascinating for me, too, as a viewer, is once you start seeing the film, you become so engrossed in that point of view and seeing the world through Scarlett Johansson's character's eyes that it does shift the way you view what's going on, the way people are moving, what people are doing with their lives. You start to kind of ask yourself certain questions, sort of fundamental questions about how different these people are really than this alien creature. And I'm guessing that was part of the goal for you there, to provoke that type of question.
Yeah, it's incredible how in films, of course, it's not the way things really are. In a film like this, where you do see her interacting with people without them, you know, knowing they're being filmed, and people on the street and shopping centres and nightclubs and so on, people just as they are, putting her in the world undisturbed kind of thing, is it? That becomes a very unusual look at us, actually. And And that's what we are. That's who we are. So we become alien somehow in the experience of watching it through her eyes. And minutiae of behavior is suddenly elevated and very interesting. And yeah, it was definitely, it's people watching.
Yeah. You talked about there was a screening here in Chicago and there was a Q&A afterwards. And one of the things you mentioned is that you had originally started out with a fairly close adaptation of the source material, the novel, when you were working on this. And then you had a sort of breakthrough where you realized you wanted to rethink your entire approach to this film. I'm wondering if you can just describe that breakthrough moment. What were the particulars of what drove that?
The novel was more descriptive and it was more polemic. It was about the meat industry, actually. It was a sort of satire, a polemic on corporate greed. It was a very interesting book, but there were aspects to it that I didn't feel like I wanted to make into a film. But the thing that I did want to make into a film was this central character in the book, and I think the film and the book remain sort of related spiritually, at least, even though the film is so different.
So the manifestation of that, really, yes, in terms of this breakthrough, in terms of how you wanted to approach it, was obviously how you chose to shoot it from the point of view you described, but particularly the improvisational nature of a lot of the dialogue,
right,
shooting people unaware,
right.
as you talked about. And I guess what I'm most curious about is, in those encounters, how you directed Scarlett Johansson, how you took control or stayed out of the way and let things just unfold.
Right. Well, one of the key discoveries in our process of writing and thinking and having thousands of conversations about the story and how we could tell it, one key realization fairly late on in the process was about shooting Scarlett in disguise, driving around in Glasgow and Scotland in a white van, speaking with an English accent on the wrong side of the road or on our side of the road, and speaking to people, you know, asking for directions from people who don't know they're being filmed. Having her walking down the street, she falls over at one point, she's picked up by people, again, they don't know they're being filmed. Nightclubs, shopping centres. We wanted to put her in the world as it is. We felt that was the much more exciting expression of this idea of an alien among us, was to literally do that. And in order to achieve that, really, we then had to work out a method of shooting undetected. So we had to invent a camera system, which we installed in the cab of the van she drives, and then the nightclub she walks through, and shopping centre, and so on and so on. And these cameras were, I suppose, the way to think of them is sort of surveillance cameras, almost. Mm-hmm. That they're hidden, Scarlett walks down the street in disguise. We all walk away, so there's no evidence of a film set anywhere, and she knows what she needs to do. And if she falls in the street, we know the cameras are pointing at that spot, and she falls there. And she knows what she's supposed to be doing. And what you watch are human being, you know, people walking down the street who go and attend to a woman who's fallen over. And they behave the way human beings behave, which is to pull her to her feet and ask her if she's okay. Does she need to sit down? Does she need a glass of water? Should they call anyone? You know, that's what you see is human kindness.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that glues us together, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is sort of really about her learning, seeing those things, and somehow them affecting her.
This is your third film as a director. Hopefully you have many more films in you, but you talk about the excitement of shooting this way. And it seems like it would be. I can imagine having that sort of electricity and just having things grow organically out of moments and that suspense of not knowing where it's going. Is it something that you think you will carry with you and may almost be a paradigm shift for you in terms of how you want to make movies? Or was it kind of a one-off, it worked because it's a perfect match of the form and the content in this case?
It's an interesting question. I think, for me, it's definitely a match of form and content. It is, the methodology and the narrative are the same thing in this story. And that's why I think it's so effective. I think it's effective. And to take that forward and use that in other films, I could, I might, but it feels like I'm more likely to become interested in something completely different and then find a way of fulfilling that.
Right.
And that may involve a completely different way of shooting again. So I'm reluctant to repeat myself, actually.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with director Jonathan Glazer. His previous work is Sexy Beast and Birth. His latest film is Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson. You've mentioned that some of the footage you shot, and this is inevitable when you're shooting people unaware, you weren't able to use it. Some people did ultimately decide, you know what, thanks but no thanks. I don't really want to be part of your little movie here. And you said that there were some what you considered beautiful scenes that you had to leave out. I'm naturally curious just for you to describe one of those scenes, but I'm also more interested just in what was it about one or two of those scenes that you had to leave out that you think would have really added something or would have been a nice additional ingredient to the mix?
Well, it's you don't know what those pieces would have given the film as it now is. So I don't mourn their loss in the film we have, because we compensated for them, or we found other ways of achieving the same note or moments. But there were people that she may have spoken to or got in the van, or who then when they discovered they were being filmed said they weren't interested or ran a mile, you know, some of them, but and understandably. But there was one particular one I remember of a couple on a park bench, and we were filming them and they were breaking up. And it was a very beautiful scene.
Wow.
But we couldn't, they weren't happy about it, I think, as you can understand.
That's sad.
It is sad.
On a lot of levels.
Yes, yes. So that sticks in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know? But we'd have production assistants who would appear from behind skips or out of phone boxes and phone booths and chase people down the street and say, we've just been filming you. You know, sometimes if there were seven or eight people who were involved interactively in the scene you were making and then they went on their respective paths, each one of them would have to be chased down by a production assistant. So
wow.
it was a strange behind the scenes, certainly.
So the dialogue, if we can call it that Scarlett Johansson has with the characters, with these men that she lures into the vehicle, a lot of it obviously unscripted. I'm curious what your direction was to her then in those scenes, or how much you really practiced that ahead of time, because it's such a fundamental part of her job or her objective. It's all contingent on her being able to get them in and being able to work her magic, if you will. And I'm just wondering how much of that was something you worked with Scarlett on, or did script out at all, or sort of just let her go and let her interact with these men.
Well, all of those things.
Okay.
We start with an idea for a scene, and we write the scene, and then within the scene there's maybe three or four pages of dialogue. And then I go up to Scotland with the scene, for instance, and if there are two or three ideas that we have in the scene that we want communicated from her, then she knows going into the scene that she needs to, you know, hit those notes with somebody who doesn't know they're being filmed. So that script would be thrown away and superseded by the reality of whatever we found. Like, we would write in London of a conversation between her and a guy getting in the van would always be superseded by a real guy getting in the van. And so it was very loose in a sense, but the margins were very clear. We understood exactly what it was we were up there to get. And you're in this perfect position, actually. It's a bit of a high wire act, but it's a lovely place to be, you know, where you kind of are in complete control and completely out of control simultaneously. It's exactly where you want to be as a filmmaker.
No girlfriend, really.
Oh, I don't have a girlfriend at all.
Very charming. Better?
Yeah, sorted.
You have a handsome face.
Aye, yeah. Thanks a lot, cheers.
You think I'm pretty?
Aye, you're gorgeous.
Do you?
Aye, definitely.
Good.
We talked a little bit about subverting some of the expectations of the science fiction genre. One of the things I really appreciated about the movie was the way I think it's almost intuitive as an audience member to expect that we would get a lot of information and then have that cut down in subsequent encounters. So, for example, the first time she lures a guy into the vehicle, we might see the whole thing play out. And then once we've seen that, we don't need to know the whole process. But actually, the first time someone gets in, he sort of just disappears and we're left to fill in the blanks. And you kind of dole out information. You keep adding to the process as we go along and instead of stripping back. And I was wondering if that was a strategy for you in terms of trying to build suspense, or was it more about trying to keep the audience from focusing too much on those details, which, as you said, weren't really what this was about for you?
Well, I think part of that is the fact that you're trying to show her routine.
Mm-hmm.
You're her work, and there is routine to work. And we needed to show that happening like on a Monday and a Tuesday and a Wednesday and a Thursday and so on. We needed to see that routine. There's no point in showing the same result each time dramatically. So we built it up, and we gave more information about what happened as those scenes. Each time you visit those scenes, you see more, you get more from each one, or more information from each one. So that I think at the beginning of the film, I hope that the way people view it is that they're being pulled into something, they're being immersed in something. They're not sitting back and watching something conventional, that they're being drawn into her point of view. And she knows what she's doing. It's for us to catch up to what she's
right.
doing.
Right. One of my favorite scenes in the film, and I'm not spoiling anything, even though it is late in the movie, there is, safe to say, a shift in this character. We start to see some more humanity injected into her life, its life. And there's a scene where she goes into a diner and gets this beautiful looking piece of cake. And it's one of those scenes that we've seen in other movies. I think of the John Carpenter film Starman. Are you familiar with that movie?
I'm not,
Jeff Bridges.
Actually, no.
But there's a scene I've always loved there, mainly because of Jeff Bridges' performance, where he is an alien, obviously, and he goes into a truck stop and he hears the waitress say to another customer, "Try the Dutch apple pie. It's terrific." Mm. And then he finally takes a bite of the Dutch apple pie and he has this almost orgasmic experience where it's this alien tasting something, you know, that amazing for the first time. It's tempting to think something like that is going to happen here as the camera studies this beautiful looking piece of cake and she goes to take the first bite. Needless to say, I won't give it away, but her reaction is not to find it the most moving experience of her life so far. And it's actually kind of a funny moment in a movie that I wouldn't describe as a comedy, certainly, and I'm sure you wouldn't either. But watching it with a crowd, there were at least four or five moments of lightness and humor where we were responding to the situation. And I'm wondering how much of that for you was something you deliberately tried to inject into the story, or it just came out naturally.
Well, I think when you're on the edge of extremes in the way you're telling a story like this, people are dying to let off steam. Mm-hmm. And those cracks, those moments in a film, some you anticipate and some you don't, where people laugh because we need to release, we need to let off steam. So some of them are, I'm delighted about the way some of them seem to play, because I think they keep people surprised and engaged. And there are lines in the film, for instance, one of the characters has a couple of lines which I think always get a laugh, and I'm always delighted that they do. But yeah, there are others that surprise me.
I did want to ask you sort of about the gender politics, if you will, of the movie, if that was something you were trying to focus on. I think it'd be almost impossible to not view the film that way, in the sense that as we see this character shift a little bit away from just her pure objective and being this alien figure into something a little bit more human, safe to say, we see how society responds to that. It's not necessarily something that is favorable, and I'll just leave it at that. And I'm curious if, you know, in having a female character and having an actress like Scarlett Johansson, someone who is viewed as such a sexy figure, for lack of a better word, and you have her in this movie seducing men, but then later becoming someone who becomes a little bit more of a victim. You know, how much of that was something you wanted to explore, the way men view women in particular, and how perhaps women are victimized in society and objectified in society, in addition to just the observational aspects that you were also exploring?
Mm. Well, that's a lovely big question for 8:45,
and we're going to end on that, actually. So take it away.
goodness me! Yes, of course. I was very aware of the gender issues of the film or gender politics of the film, but underneath it all, I was more involved in her as a human being. In other words, the story of her as a human being, or before her as a woman, that was more predominant in the way we thought about it. In terms of Scarlett, I think she is objectified in a lot of roles she takes or has been given, and that's inevitable, I think, given that the films that she's in some cases. But I think here, I think what was really powerful about her in this film, what is powerful about her in this film, is that by being in this film and how she behaves in this film and how fearlessly she goes about it, I think she somehow de-eroticizes that image, almost reclaims it for herself. And I think that's really very striking and very brave.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's also a very good actress. But
right.
But it's, I think it demonstrates the fact that, you know, you have to take a risk. You have to take risks. You have to, you know, not taking a risk is actually taking a risk. You should go for it and be prepared to sort of lose everything in the process. And that's what she does here. And I think she wins everything in the process. She's very strong in the film.
She certainly is. Mm. And I would love to spend a lot more time talking about this movie, including the great locations, the rural locations you have here are almost like another planet and are fascinating to watch. I'd love to go back and ask you about Sexy Beast, but I think we are out of time. So thank you very much, Jonathan. Best of luck with the movie. I really enjoyed it.
Nice talking to you. Thanks.
Again, Under the Skin just opened this weekend in Chicago and select cities. And my thanks again to Jonathan Glazer for engaging me in that early morning chat. Josh, you haven't had a chance to see Under the Skin yet, and unfortunately won't have a chance to see it before we tape our next show. So it might be a little while before it comes up again. With that in mind, I want to say, for all of our listeners, despite the fact that I know saying this, putting this on the record, is now assuredly going to doom your experience with the movie, Under the Skin is for me the film of the year so far.
So you're saying I'm going to go into it wanting to dislike it?
No, not necessarily that. I'm going to say having too high expectations.
Ah, okay.
So,
well, it has been getting rave reviews across the board, pretty much. I don't know if I've seen someone offer, you know, either on Letterboxd or Twitter, a negative response to it. So, yeah, my expectations are pretty high, but that's all right. That's a good thing.
There is at least one, Richard Brody in The New Yorker.
Oh, really? I did not see that one.
Not in that review, but elsewhere referred to it as, quote, terrible.
That wasn't him in The New Yorker going on and on about Johansson. That must have been a different piece.
That was a different piece.
Okay.
That was Anthony Lane.
There you go.
And that's a topic for another time. In our bonus content on this week's episode, we are going to share some additional audio from that Glazer interview, plus a little fun with the recent BuzzFeed list of 200 classic movies you need to see. We're going to share the movies we're most ashamed to admit we've never seen. We do, of course, also need to make some time in Bonus Josh for all the movies you got wrong in my absence.
Oh, my goodness.
And that could just fill an hour.
It's going to go till the wee hours of the early morning.
You know what? It's not going to happen this time.
Okay,
we're going to table
that.
Can we
take them one bonus section at a time?
Exactly.
Right,
so we'll save that. That's a little bit of a tease. We'll hopefully get to that in a future episode. If you want to get our bonus audio, you can do that by checking out the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone. Learn more at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps.
Okay, you're on a desert island. You only have a state-of-the-art home theater system to keep you company. And a soda fountain. And some popcorn. You want popcorn or snow caps, Adam?
Are you serious with this? You're bringing snow caps into the conversation versus popcorn?
Yeah, I'm popcorn myself.
How dare you?
Good. Popcorn it is.
Yes.
All right. What five directors' filmographies have to be available to you? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
I came here to wake with you at dawn, with no understanding of any wrong, to lay with you for endless nights, trade the wreckage for the lights, a hazel eyed, strong-willed, brown-haired girl. So hold tight to break free. Well, you've got all of me. Take me in, I'll be good to you, baby. Do my damnedest to make mistakes but once.
The music there of Chuck Reagan. We heard the tune Something May Catch Fire, which I can't stop listening to, and Wake With You there from his new album Till Midnight. In addition to his solo work, Reagan is a member of the Florida-based punk band Hot Water Music, and he's currently on tour. And coming to Chicago, Josh, he's scheduled to play at the Metro April 16th. So if you like what you hear, you can check out that show. More information available at chuckreaganmusic.com. Before we get to our donations, I did want to take just a moment to thank everyone for allowing me to have that little sabbatical I've had away from the show. For people who missed episode 479, where I discussed the circumstances, it did relate to one of my younger sisters having some pretty serious health issues, and I'm happy to report that she is well on her way to recovery. She's still got a long process ahead, but she is making progress, and having that month away to be with my family and to be able to help her out specifically, she spent a good chunk of that at our house here in Chicago, was very beneficial. And that was, Josh, the longest I've ever been away from the show. I think the longest span of time between episodes, or at least recording something for Film Spotting in 10 years has been 10 days or so.
That's crazy.
So to go that long, and all I did was, you know, one little hit for those passes we gave away, and I did record two interviews, so I guess I didn't stay completely away, but went a few weeks without doing anything audio related for the show, and it's been a while, and it was something that needed to be done. And can't thank Michael Phillips enough for being that backup who came in and just hit it out of the park and was a great listen every week. We're so lucky to have him as part of the Film Spotting family. Josh, you did an incredible job stepping up and taking on a role that you really haven't had with the show before. Thank you for that.
Yeah, you
and
got it.
Of course, to Sam and Joe and Candace and everyone who makes this show possible, mainly you, the listeners, as well. Got many emails and tweets and Facebook posts with well wishes from people who were concerned and were looking forward to my return. So that was very encouraging. Thank you, everyone.
Just so you know, that broken lamp in the Pantheon room, that was Michael.
Of course it was. I have no doubt
you
it was Michael.
Me?
Yeah, I do. And speaking of broken,
oh,
as we get to our donations, I think about your pronunciation, Josh.
You'll have to be more specific.
Yeah, I will. On last week's show, my fellow Iowan, Adam.
Oh, boy.
Shares a name with me, too. From where, Josh? Do you want to try to pronounce that one more time?
Decora?
Yes.
What did I say?
You called it Decora.
Decora? That's not even possible.
Well,
that would be Decora.
You know what? But why would you know some random small town in Iowa?
Well, see, this is what happens when you leave me in charge. All of Iowa is at risk.
I meant to put a pronunciation thing because, of course, I put that in the show notes, and I meant to put a pronunciation guide. Thought, nah, Decora is good.
Now, at this point, why would you ever think that?
I know. Adam, our apologies. Let's get to some donations. We start with a great note here and a platinum level donation from Drew Brennan.
Adam and Josh, I've been an avid listener of Film Spotting for a long time now, and so this donation is long overdue. The countless hours of entertainment your show has provided me over the years, whether I am on my commute to work, a long drive, or just walking around the city, has been just awesome. I love being a part of a group of people who love movies as much as me, and living here in Chicago, I have enjoyed coming to your live shows and also taking your class at the University of Chicago, Adam. Keep up the great work, and thanks for giving me an outlet to think about and look at films in a different way.
Thank you very much, Drew. He was a great member of my class at the University of Chicago a couple summers ago where we focused on cinema verite, and Drew was as well at our last live show, maybe other ones, Josh, but he was there with, I believe at the time, I could be wrong, but I believe at the time his fiancée. They have since gotten married, so congratulations, Drew, on that. I hope to see Drew and some other listeners this summer at the University of Chicago. I'm going to use this transition to shamelessly plug my class. It is Remembering Roger Ebert, a celebration of his favorite films. It's an 8-week course. It's open to anybody. You don't have to be a student at the University of Chicago. It starts, I believe, July 8th, right after the July 4th holiday, we start the class. And the conceit of the class, if you will, is we're going to focus on not only his favorite films, but his favorite overlooked films, because that was something that was so vital to Ebert and his criticism. I think that's something we all took away from it, is being turned on to certain movies because Ebert was someone who championed them. So the class is going to focus on those movies that he really pushed for.
Yeah, I'm going to try to drop in, actually, and I'm circling, I think it's a July class, when you're going to do Floating Weeds.
Yes.
Because as we'll talk about in our bonus content about what 200 classic films have you seen, I'm short on Ozu viewing. So that's one.
A good excuse for you to focus
on
that.
Exactly. Yep.
Looking forward to having you as a guest at one of the classes. I'm going to have some other guests lined up as well. So if you're interested in taking that class, go to filmspotting.net. There's a link to the registration information and more in our top stories. And if for some reason you can't find it there at filmspotting.net, just shoot us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and I will share it with you. We also have a new $5 a month subscriber. He is Steve here in Evanston, Illinois. And another donor we want to thank this week with a great cause to support. He is Danny Harvey.
Hi, guys. It's been far too long since I last donated to your great show. I've been a listener since about episode 10, and Film Spotting is a firm fixture of my week that I always look forward to. On Sunday, the 13th of April, I will be running the London Marathon, and I will be carrying you on my iPod while I try my best to complete the 26.2-mile course. One of the charities I'm raising money for is Meta Cinema. They are a British charity who install and manage permanent, state-of-the-art cinemas in hospitals and places of care. Their aim, by bringing the joy of cinema, is to enrich the lives of patients, many of whom are critically ill or disabled and spend extensive periods of time in the hospital or undergoing treatment. It would be great if you could give a short shout-out for this great charity for all your UK listeners. Thanks for all you guys do. I look forward to listening for many years to come.
So we will link to that cause, if you want to donate, in our show notes at filmspotting.net. But I really did want to single that one out, Josh, because of course, we're going to have a little extra incentive for any cause that is centered around cinema. And it's something I've been interested in going back many years. I remember I used to go to my Hollywood video store locally back when there were video stores, and they had some kind of flyer out about a program they had where they'd bring movies and have these movie nights. And I remember sending an email or even calling them and saying, you know, this is something my show would like to get behind. We could donate or host a movie night. And I never got a response, and it just kind of died. But I would like to do something like that. I'd like to do more of that kind of stuff. And this just seems like a great thing to support. So we're definitely behind it.
I hadn't heard of anything like this with the cinemas in the hospitals, but what a great idea. It makes perfect sense. I mean, you are sitting around so often with family, and to be able to do something like that, to get away, to explore a movie, wonderful.
I also wanted to read this email we got from a listener named Jared Skarsten Menasha. He is in Wisconsin, and it goes back to kind of what Drew was saying in his note about having somewhat of a film community that he can be part of. That's what Jared is looking for.
I've been listening to your podcast for 3 years and look forward to every episode. I love discussing film and hearing other people's takes on movies, whether I like them or not. The problem is, I'm a 17-year-old high school student in Wisconsin, and it is difficult to find people who can discuss films like Bicycle Thieves or The Grandmaster, or even have seen them. I think it'd be a really great idea to somehow create a forum for film spotting listeners to somehow find other locals to discuss film with. I know that's not a very clear suggestion, but I trust you guys to figure something out. Also, may I suggest Mason Jennings, a folksy musical artist who would be a great fit for the musical portion of the podcast. I promise to donate once the funds are available also, but college is expensive.
Tell me about it. I'm still paying for it, Jared, so I have no qualms with you for not donating to the show, and we will check out Mason Jennings and see if he's a good fit for the show. But we got that email, and we occasionally see emails like that, so I thought, Josh, it was a perfect opportunity to mention to our listeners who may not be aware that in the Film Spotting Forum, which you can find simply by going to filmspotting.net and in the nav, click on forum. Great community of film spotting listeners. Very active and engaging. There is a thread that you can dive into that's called Local Events and Meetups. And that's what it's all about. It's about film spotting listeners connecting with other film spotting listeners. And I will admit that it's not the most active forum there on the boards, but I'd like it to be more active. And maybe if people like Jared and others listening go in and check it out more often, sign up, register for the forum, and share where they are and that they're looking for other people. I know those connections have already been made, and maybe more connections can be made, and guys like Jared can find other people who are interested in talking about cinema. He can find it there virtually. He can talk with people about those movies, but if he is looking for something a little more face-to-face in his area, the forum might be a good place to, again, make some of those connections. So we highly recommend the forum and hope that is somewhat of an answer for you there, Jared. Our thanks to all of our donors, including, of course, our monthly subscribers, whether it's $2 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month. You really keep us doing what we're doing. And we also, in closing, Josh, have to plug our buddy Jeff Goldsmith and his Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast, where you hear great interviews with screenwriters. That podcast is available in iTunes. He also produces the Backstory magazine app, available for iPad. More information at backstory.net.
I came in batting down a song, burn pages to the moon.
Hey there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Matt Singer here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And in our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I study the code of Bushido as we discuss Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai.
And in honor of Forrest Whitaker's character Ghost Dog, who practices with a samurai sword, even though he's practical enough to stick with guns most of the time, we take a look at some favorite films and TV shows featuring memorable sword fights that you can stream or rent at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
But it is so easy. All you gotta do.
Welcome back. back to Film Spotting. That's music from The Commitments, the 1991 movie adaptation of the Roddy Doyle novel about an Irish soul band, and a movie that would accompany director David Gordon Green to a desert island along with the filmographies of his desert island directors, which is the subject of this week's Film Spotting Top 5. I'm happy to report, Josh, that yes, David Gordon Green was game to play along with our silly little bit of nonsense here, and with only a little bit of advance warning, rattled off his picks, including arguably a couple of surprises. So before we get into our list, here he is with his answer to the question. You're alone on a desert island. You've got a TV and a DVD player, somehow. The complete works of which five directors do you bring along?
Well, it's a tough question. I know, regardless of what I say, I'm going to wake up tomorrow kicking myself for not giving the other guy. But I would say Alan Parker, Robert Altman, John Ford, Stanley Kubrick, and John Landis.
Really?
Yeah.
John Landis maybe stands out a little bit, but obviously a person who tremendously influential right about the time you were probably really discovering cinema.
All the R-rated movies that I wasn't supposed to see that were really inspiring, from American Werewolf to Blues Brothers, so many great movies. And diverse, you know, these are guys that I think, outside of John Ford, who I think stuck to one thing and did it really, really well, a lot of these guys I just find as role models thematically that jump genres, jump content, structure and style, and have a lot of surprises and the roller coasters of their careers.
What are the Alan Parker films that stand out from you? He's a director, I have to confess, I don't think in the 10 years of doing this show has come up very often. He's not someone who gets a lot of love.
You know what? And that's true, because I don't think he doesn't splash the film by Alan Parker kind of label. He doesn't have that signature branding about him because he's constantly challenging himself and doing something new, from Mississippi Burning to Midnight Express to Road to Wellville, The Commitments, Evita. So many incredible movies that guy has made that are all over the place. I mean, he's just always looking at new. I mean, a lot, you could look at music as a theme because that's certainly a reoccurring thing. Bugsy Malone. I mean, you know, who doesn't want a good Scott Baio movie on their resume?
Cheer up. There's a million other jobs. Sure, Buster, standing on the street corner with a hat to catch the dimes in.
It's only a matter of time. I just cool down.
Look, Buster, I've been walking the streets of New York for 6 months now. The only fancy steps I've been doing is to avoid the man who collects the rent.
So it takes time to be a movie star. We can always come back tomorrow.
Alan Parker, not a name that gets invoked much here on Film Spotting. Scott Baio, never been invoked.
First time, huh?
In 10 years on Film Spotting. But there he is in Alan Parker's Bugsy Malone from 1976. Of course, the very memorable, I would say even infamous, if you will, gangster film set in Depression-era Chicago and acted by an all-child cast, with music, and also starring Jodie Foster. You have to love the 70s. Alan Parker, the director, and one of Gordon Green's five desert island directors, along with Altman, Kubrick, Ford, and Landis. You heard him list those picks there. Josh, I know that one of those names, spoiler alert here, appears on your list, but did any of Green's other picks get any consideration?
Not really. Ford would be the only one.
Yeah, I kicked that one around.
He's kind of an obvious one, but this is quite an interesting list Green came up with here. I never would have guessed Parker. I mean, Landis is an oddball choice, but I kind of understand it just because I know fanatics who love everything he's done. I've never heard anyone talk about Parker that way. So won't be making my list. I do want to clarify a few things before I start with my number five. We're not on this island together, right? For sure. It's my island, and then you're on your other island. Maybe we can see each other, like there's 30 yards of water in between.
Sounds like wishful thinking on your part. I love that you went there, though. You had to think about that before doing your list.
I took this.
Am I stuck with him?
I took this literally because, honestly, it was one way to keep this from being the top five directors of all time list.
Right.
Because it's not that.
It's not
something
that.
A little bit different.
Absolutely.
So I went with directors, you know, who didn't do a lot with water, because I imagine I'm going to be thirsty on this island. But I also seriously didn't want to double up on similar genres. I didn't want to double up on similar thematic concerns or styles because, you know, we're going to be on these islands for a while. I want some variety. So to keep this from being the top five directors of all time, I looked for a little variation here.
Okay. I did the same, though. For once, you may have thought about a list and broken it down more than I did.
Not possible.
I don't know. I think maybe you did. You have a lot more criteria this time than I did. But I do want to say this as we set up the top five, that it did occur to me as I was thinking about these picks, and this, of course, was very, very hard. It couldn't be a more arbitrary list because it is so random and, of course, not likely to ever happen. Let's say that.
We hope.
Yeah, and most of our top fives are arbitrary, but like any good list, this one really does force you to consider what you value in cinema, I think. And the real challenge for me was after you get past the obvious criteria, things like quantity of films, quality in terms of story, cast, script, directing, the overall entertainment value, whatever you normally look for, you do have to realize, or I at least realize, that I also watch movies very much for edification, whether on a superficial level. So when I'm at a cocktail party, because when I'm not here at the studio, I actually do spend most of my time living in high society, yes, New York circa 1952, I can say, yes, I've seen that. I have thoughts about it. Let's talk about it. Or to watch these films and see how these filmmakers reckon with the larger philosophical questions of life. The problem is, if you're stranded on a desert island, you don't have anyone to impress.
Nobody cares what you're watching.
No, nor do you really need provocation to reckon with these serious questions, because all you have is time to think about them. The chances of you being able to apply any insights whatsoever you've gleaned from a work of art to your everyday existence are nil. You're all alone. So what I'm really trying to say in summary is Ingmar Bergman is just an honorable mention for me.
That's your excuse, huh?
That's it.
All right, I'll take it. Number five for me, Akira Kurosawa. He strikes me as an elemental filmmaker. This is going a little bit against what you just said, though. His movies do wrestle with these sorts, yeah, of questions that we're always going to wrestle with and will probably never fully figure out. I mean, consider 1950s Rashomon, which is set in 11th century Japan. It features frequent Kurosawa collaborator Toshiro Mifune as a bandit who encounters an aristocrat and his wife in the woods. A crime occurs, and later on, witnesses give varying reports, conflicting testimonies as to what might have happened. So this is all about the definition of truth, the mystery of human nature, really good fodder for desert island debates, which I'm going to be having with myself, right?
This is what I'm saying.
Well, maybe I'm more open to just talking to myself, I guess. And similarly to Rashomon, Ikiru is about nothing less than the prospect of facing death. Stray Dog explores the nature of evil. These are big bedeviling ideas at, yes, play here. But here's the thing about Kurosawa. I'm also going to have a number of grand entertainments along with me, like The Seven Samurai or like Yojimbo. So he definitely brings that to the table, too. The list could go on. He directed over 30 films, but you get the idea. These films, they're from one of the early masters of world cinema, and they just have to be on that island with me. Hmm.
It's a great pick, and one I definitely considered along with Ingmar Bergman before I wrote it off for just being too damn heavy for this desert island. But I don't know if you saw it. Just last night, before coming in here to record the show, I posted on our Twitter page and our Facebook page a challenge to give a listener a Film Spotting t-shirt if they could most closely predict my top five.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
And I'm going to report that even though many, many listeners responded, and many listeners know me very well when you look at their picks and you consider my top five and my honorable mentions, nobody got more than three right. And I think a big reason why is because of my number five pick. Nobody guessed this filmmaker. And before I say the name, before I reveal my pick, I do want to give a little bit of an explanation. One of the first images that popped into my head, thinking about being alone on a desert island, was, believe it or not, Charlton Heston at the beginning of The Omega Man. He's basically the last man,
okay,
on Earth. And one of his rituals to pass the time, anybody who's seen the movie will remember, is to go to his nearby movie theater and he strings up the last movie that was playing there, which is Woodstock the movie. We see him watching and reciting lines from it. It could be any movie, really, and probably something meant to be ironic in the fact that a movie about idealism and all the possibilities for humanity is being juxtaposed with this film, this setting of destruction and the complete absence of humanity, not to mention the irony of Mr. NRA himself, Chuck Heston, reveling in these damn hippies.
This is really beautiful, right? You know, like, you know, you have to realize the turnaround that I've gone through in the last 3 days. Just to really realize what's really important. What's really important, the fact that if we can't all live together and be happy, if you have to be afraid to walk out in the street, if you have to be afraid to smile at somebody, right? What kind of a way is that to go through this life?
I thought there was something poignant about this lonely guy just wanting to immerse himself with other people, masses of people, real people, as far as the eye can see. And that made me think of the documentarian Frederick Wiseman. Made 42 documentary films, starting with Titicut Follies in 1967. A lot of them, I'll admit, I still haven't seen. And part of that is because they're not readily available. You have to catch them either on PBS or you can order them from his Zipporah Films website. It's Zipporah.com. That's where I ordered Titicut and High School and Public Housing, which was shot here in Chicago. He uses those kinds of titles because he often dives into these institutions, these basic pillars of society. Movies like Law and Order, Basic Training, Boxing Gym, Hospital, Ballet. He goes into these worlds that are microcosms of society and largely gets out of the way. He's an invisible filmmaker, but he has these amazing instincts in terms of where to put the camera, where to focus the camera, and where to find the story in the editing once he's gone through all of that footage. And I guess I just figured if I'm going to be alone like Chuck Heston, I want to be reminded of the full spectrum of humanity, the beautiful, the bad, the in-between, and that is what Frederick Wiseman captures. I still need to see At Berkeley Part 2. That was his documentary from last year, four-hour, two-part film about a semester, I think the fall of 2010, at Berkeley out in California, and really explores what a public institution, what a state institution has to go through and the classroom dynamics and everything associated with a school like that. Part one was really good, and I still need to see part two, like I said, but being able to dive into that mass of humanity is something I think I'd want to do if I was all alone.
Well, I would have predicted a documentarian for your list. Actually, I don't know if I would have landed on Wiseman, but it does make sense. I think this is one of the elemental ways you and I differ, though. I never occurred to me, as much as I do appreciate documentaries and often will have one or two on my top 10 list at the end of every year, never occurred to me to think of a documentary filmmaker for this list. There's maybe something for me too literal about them that is exactly what you appreciate,
right?
It sounds like, but for me, it doesn't sound appealing to have that with me on the island, even though I can think, even as I'm saying that, of documentaries like my favorite movie of last year, Leviathan, that's not literal at all, very immersive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's painting them a little bit too broadly, but still, this is why I'm glad we have these separate islands, you know, and it's
right.
Not a joint list. My number four is someone that David Gordon Green did actually pick. It's Stanley Kubrick, totally with him there. I realize I don't want to only have directors whose work I have a pretty good handle on. I want someone whose work I'm still wrestling with. And the truth is, I haven't figured Stanley Kubrick out yet. I mean, even after our recent Sacred Cow review of 2001: A Space Odyssey, I did feel I was maybe a bit closer to wrapping my mind around that, but I'm still left with that crucial question of whether Kubrick is this clinical humanist or this doomsday pessimist. I'm leaning toward the latter. I think you differ from me there. But really, this is a question that you could apply to a lot of Kubrick's work. Paths of Glory, A Clockwork Orange, probably Full Metal Jacket, what perspective he's coming from and he's trying to communicate. Kubrick also, though, a little bit like Kurosawa, it isn't always heavy lifting. It's going to be nice to have some comedies on this island, even if Dr. Strangelove or Barry Lyndon, they aren't comedies of the conventional kind. So Kubrick is a filmmaker that haunts me. When I typed his name into my own website search engine just to revisit some of the things I'd written, it brought up all his films, but also every time I've referenced him in other reviews, and I realized I reference this guy a lot. So I think that sort of speaks to how I am still wrestling with him and his influence, which is why I'd want those films with me.
Yeah, you explained it well, and it does make total sense. At the same time, when you did reveal to me that Kubrick was going to make your list, and he was someone who, when I first started just rolling filmmakers around in my head, Kubrick was number one on my list.
Okay.
I think people who've listened to the show, especially some of those Sacred Cow discussions, even though we were both on the same page more or less with 2001 in terms of its greatness, safe to say I come off as more of a Kubrick fanboy than you. And that's something that I've only come to recently because of a lot of these discussions. I mean, I've always liked him and respected him as a filmmaker, but I've gotten to the point where, you know, I've said on the show, he might be our greatest filmmaker. I mean, you could really have that conversation. So he was one I was kicking around and pleasantly surprised to see him make your list. So just off my list. I had one documentarian with my number five pick. I've got another one at number four. That's one of the many hats this filmmaker wears. He is Werner Herzog. And when I gave my list to our producer, Sam, he said this: between Wiseman and Herzog, you've pretty much got humanity documented from the mundane to the sublime.
Hmm.
So Sam, as he usually does, absolutely nailed it. I don't know if I would have said it that well, that eloquently and succinctly, but he nailed exactly why I have Frederick Wiseman on this list and why I have a director like Werner Herzog as well. You have 60 plus movies to keep you occupied. And as we said, quantity does matter somewhat here as you're all alone for who knows how much time. But during my interview with David Gordon Green earlier in the show, he mentioned the influence of Herzog with narrative movies like Strocek with Bruno S. But of course, you've got all those great collaborations with Klaus Kinski that have become film spotting favorites like Fitzcarraldo and Aguirre, The Wrath of God, also Nosferatu. Then those docs, experimental stuff to chew on like Fata Morgana and Lessons of Darkness, with more traditional documentaries like Grizzly Man, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, of course, remade later by Herzog as Rescue Dawn, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, Encounters at the End of the World, which is a movie I like, not as much as the other docs I just mentioned, but it's a film where he travels to Antarctica and shows you all the creatures who inhabit this strange space, including some of the people who have found their way there, and gets into their stories a little bit. Herzog just takes his camera into places very, very few filmmakers are curious enough to go. And if they are curious enough, they're maybe not daring and dumb enough to go. And again, I just imagine myself being stuck on an island, wanting to be transported, wanting movies to be my escape. Who else but Herzog is going to take you to not only Antarctica, but Laos, Kuwait, the Sahara, the Amazon jungle? You can go on and on and on with him.
You do realize, though, you're essentially bringing Herzog with you as well, not just his films. I mean, the way he inserts himself, particularly in the documentaries, mm-hmm. obviously, you're okay with that. You're okay with having him on the island, too.
A world without Werner Herzog's voice is not a world I want to inhabit.
One of these disoriented or deranged penguins showed up at the New Harbor diving camp, already some 80 kilometers away from where it should be. The rules for the humans are: do not disturb or hold up the penguin. Stand still and let him go on his way. And here he's heading off into the interior of the vast continent. With 5,000 kilometers ahead of him, he's heading towards certain death.
My number three is Robert Bresson. This was the first marathon that I was a part of after joining the show, and what a rich filmography to begin with. You have Alhazard Balthazar, his Portrait of Humanity through the Eyes of a Passive Donkey. It's one of my top 10 of all time when we recently forced ourselves to do that list around the Sight and Sound list. We also watched Mouchette, A Man Escaped, Pickpocket, and Diary of a Country Priest. These are all sparse and challenging pictures that grapple at some level with the distance between God and man. And if Kubrick jokes around some of these same big questions at times, Bresson really agonizes over them. I mean, on this island, I don't know which filmmaker would have to be the chaser if I'd watch Bresson and then go to Kubrick to lighten the mood, or vice versa. Well, I can't imagine Bresson ever lightening any mood, though.
No.
So probably Kubrick would be second. Bresson, he is. He's the tougher watch, A Clockwork Orange notwithstanding, with his preference for rigid performances, stark compositions, his unflinching camera. He turns acts of extreme discipline into art. But, you know, sometimes the tough watches, those are the most rewarding ones.
They are indeed. You're listening to Film Spotting, where we're sharing our top five desert island directors, not necessarily our favorite directors, not necessarily even the ones we would say are the best directors of all time, though there is likely some crossover. There are a lot of other factors we're considering. And before we get to my number three pick, I do want to give a shout out to the listener who suggested this top five. It's one we had never really considered, oddly enough, but Mindaugas Mozuris, about a month ago, sent us this idea. He said he was listening to an amazing interview with none other than Stanley Kubrick,
okay.
Pretty appropriate. And he says he came up with this question: which director's filmography would you bring with you to a desert island to watch for eternity? For all you know, makes you consider variety and number of movies each created. Difficult choice, I'd say. That's Mindaugas. He's in Vilnius, Lithuania. We're continuing our international theme here. Love getting emails from listeners in Lithuania and great top five ideas from listeners from anywhere. He shared his top five We'll share it at the end of this segment. My number three Desert Island director is Howard Hawks. And in response to my challenge on Twitter last night, one of our listeners, Michael Spar, said, when people do these lists, they never include a good genre director to provide some variety. My choice, John Carpenter. Michael makes a really valid point, but I think we probably would both agree that the ideal scenario here, you touched on this a little bit, would be to pick directors who worked in multiple genres so you could have some variety. I like John Carpenter a lot. I don't know that I'd want to watch that same style. Not that they're all exactly the same, but he makes a lot of horror, you know, thrillers and sometimes with some humor. I might get a little bit tired of that for all eternity. So with that in mind, I go to a director like Hawks, who made 47 films covering genres like adventure dramas. You've got To Have and Have Not, Only Angels Have Wings, both films I like quite a bit. Comedies like 20th Century, Bringing Up Baby, His Girl Friday, Monkey Business with Cary Grant, Marilyn Monroe, and I Was a Male War Bride, also with Cary Grant. Of course, he made The Big Sleep, which is a classic hard-boiled detective film noir. He made sci-fi movies with The Thing from Another Planet, which inspired Carpenter's
Yeah, you got Carpenter covered right there.
There it is. Musicals, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and, yes, westerns, Red River and Rio Bravo. He made, arguably, the definitive film in a bunch of those genres. If you think about it, for me, His Girl Friday is the ultimate screwball comedy. Yeah. The Big Sleep, right up there in terms of the ultimate film noirs. And Rio Bravo, hands down for me, my favorite Western. And really, I think you can make the case to just pick Hawks for this Desert Island list just to make sure you had Rio Bravo there, if nothing else. Because if I'm going to be stuck by myself for the end of time, I want to be stuck with John Wayne's Sheriff John T. Chance and Dean Barton's The Dude and Ricky Nelson's Colorado and, yes, Walter Brennan's Stumpy, just as they're stuck together in that jail waiting for bad Nathan Burdett to make his move. Howard Hawks, just covering that classical Hollywood cinema, all those different types of films, and some true masterpieces in there as well. Had to be on my list.
No more cow.
No more cow.
To be roping.
To be roping.
No more stray.
No more stray.
Will I see
round the bend.
Round the bend.
She'll be waiting.
She'll be waiting.
For my rifle pony. And me, for my rifle, my pony, and me.
Hey, that's real pretty. Go on, play some more. Why don't you play something I can sing with you?
Yeah, that's a great pick. I mean, you've got everything you need right there. My number two is going to be a much more contemporary name, and probably one, if I had put that challenge out, listeners would have guessed. It's Wes Anderson. It's my sheer pleasure pick. The movies that are simply going to give me the most comfort and the most joy, even if melancholy is probably the best way to describe Anderson's films. I also thought that these all can't be canon picks. I wanted to have one that I have the privilege of living with now, because I think we have unique relationships with the work of those directors who are active at the same exact time that we're active as viewers. You know, think about being able to be in Kubrick or Bresson's original audience. As much as we can appreciate and go back and revisit those films today, it's still different, I believe. We're viewing those through a different lens than something like The Grand Budapest Hotel, which mm-hmm. just came out. And the other thing about Anderson's films, and this has been heard quite often by me in terms of The Grand Budapest Hotel, is that they're demanding of repeated viewings, which obviously is going to be essential in this scenario. One viewing can concentrate on the music in his films. I mean, you can simply explore what he's chosen in terms of music, how he uses it, and what it means. You can do the same thing with the set designs. You can do the same thing with the costumes. I mean, really, every element of filmmaking is so intricately layered and meticulously designed here that his films, they're just rich for continual exploration. And this also brings me back to comedy again. I mean, if Kubrick's comedies make me laugh in my head a little bit, Anderson's are the ones that make me laugh out loud and in my heart, even if I know the joke is coming. Michael Phillips, when he was filling in and we did our Wes Anderson show and picked scenes, that one he chose from Rushmore with Bill Murray turning around and going after his bratty kid in the car, that's one I mentioned to Michael. I just burst out loud, even though I can predict to the exact nanosecond when Bill Murray is going to snap. It still gets me. Now, Adam, I know that you were a little bit tepid unsure about the Grand Budapest Hotel. So I'm partly making this pick to kind of force you to do that bonus content down the road here,
where
I can try to convince you of what you might have missed.
We will get to that at some point, I promise. And we'll go for my number two pick to a comedy filmmaker, a director who really is known mostly for his comedies, though that's not all he does. And another one that, yes, many listeners predicted correctly for me, and that's Woody Allen. The pro with Woody is that he's got almost 50 movies as a director to choose from. The con is that those 50 movies include direct like Hollywood Ending and Small Time Crooks.
Yeah, the ratio isn't necessarily
and Curse
great.
Of the Jade Scorpion. But Josh, despite that ratio, and I've never really sat down and actually mapped it out, I would still say there are more positives than negatives for me anyway with Woody's career. That list also includes four of my top 50 films of all time. And I'm guessing here because I've never actually sat down and made a list of my top 50 films ever, but Annie Hall would be there. Manhattan would be there. Crimes and Misdemeanors would be there. Hannah and Her Sisters maybe on the outside looking into those 50, but it'd be in the running. These are movies you talked about rewatchability with Wes Anderson. Maybe not as much exploration with Woody in these films, though I think there's plenty to mine. They are, for me, simply that rewatchable. I love the stories. I love the characters. I love the jokes in these films. And you certainly aren't getting the variety genre-wise that someone like Howard Hawks offers, but you do have silly comedies like Bananas and Take the Money and Run and Love and Death, and then those more sophisticated ones like Annie Hall and Manhattan, but also Purple Rose of Cairo, which I love, and Radio Days. And then you can go to those serious dramas. I can get into the Josh Brisson watching mode on my desert island and take in movies like Interiors and Another Woman and even Matchpoint. Some movies, I think, like Sweet and Lowdown, they have only gotten better with time the more I've seen them. So I think Woody as well might be a nice counter to my previous pick, Howard Hawks, and all of his testosterone, with Woody having so many of his movies featuring really dominant, really strong female characters.
And you, in a way, have the Ingmar Bergman pick covered a little
bit. You do, don't
you? A little
bit. With especially Another Woman and Interiors. Yes, indeed.
All right. Number one. It was the one, for me, I knew it was going to be number one right away, Alfred Hitchcock. This would have been the case no matter what, but I had a recent experience that just solidified it for me. You know, often we're watching things because of something. We have an upcoming review of it, or we're doing research for a top five list. I find it's rare that I'm watching something impulsively these days, just because I'm in the mood for it. And this isn't a bad thing. It's just the way we're consuming movies. Well, a few weeks ago, I just found myself having this longing to watch a Hitchcock film. I just wanted to watch one. It'd been a while, and I had this overwhelming urge for the kind of experience that only his films can give. Now, thankfully, I was able to scratch that itch because Michael Phillips and I were doing our top five movie Boat, so I got a chance to watch Lifeboat for the first time. There's also a practical reason, though, to put him at number one, and it goes back to your Hawks pick a little bit.
There's not a practical reason to have a boat on a desert island?
Well,
maybe you could learn something and escape, get away.
Though with Hitchcock's filmography, maybe I wouldn't want to leave.
True.
He's got something in just about every genre, like Hawks, and he's done it well, like Hawks. I mean, he's got horror with Psycho and The Birds, thriller with Vertigo and Shadow of a Doubt, romance with Notorious and To Catch a Thief, a spy caper like North by Northwest, and then comedies, too. The Trouble with Harry, and maybe we're back to The Birds again. Of course, there's also the fact that I've been using Rear Window as my default answer to that question you and I get from time to time. What's your favorite movie of all time? Rear Window is where I've been going lately. Mostly, though, my reason for Hitchcock at number one is it's just simple. His movies are art and entertainment in one brilliant package just about every time.
How's your leg?
It hurts a little.
And your stomach?
Empty as a football.
And do you love life?
Not too active.
Anything else bothering you?
Mm-hmm. Who are you?
Can't argue with it. Hitchcock was someone I strongly considered, and I think this is probably a good time for us to mention the list from our listener who gave us this topic, the Desert Island directors. Mindaugas, he had Akira Kurosawa and Stanley Kubrick and Alfred Hitchcock, just like
very
you.
Very nice.
And he also had Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg. Mm. So a good list there from our listener in Lithuania. And that brings us to my number one. I mentioned that non-existent list of my top 50 films of all time. It'd have three Woody Allen movies on it. It would also have three films from Billy Wilder: Double Indemnity, The Apartment, and Sunset Boulevard. And here's the thing about Wilder. I almost equally love Ace in the Hole and Stalag 17. Some Like It Hot is my number six Billy Wilder film, for crying out loud. This movie that, you know, is among the top 100 all time for AFI, and a ton of critics would probably put it in their top 10 or 20 ever, maybe one of their favorite comedies of all time, even higher. But for me, it's even behind those other five films. That's how much I love them. And yes, with Wilder, there is some minor stuff. You, on your recent show with Michael, talking about sex-obsessed characters, talked about the seven-year itch. For me, Monroe almost salvages that movie. I find that Tom Ewell
performance. Not a fan of Tom Ewell, huh?
And that character really just really troubling.
Really?
And not fun at all in that movie. And you also get movies like Kiss Me Stupid, but there's other less regarded stuff from Wilder, like Witness for the Prosecution with Tyrone Power and Marlena Dietrich and Charles Laughton, and his first film, The Major and the Minor, which, yes, is about an army major played by Ray Milland, who gets mixed up with a woman played by Ginger Rogers, who's pretending to be, yes, a minor to get a cheaper train fare. I really love The Major and the Minor as well. And I guess I figure as well, Josh, if I'm going to be looking for a friend on that island, because I don't have you, you're apparently miles away.
Or,
we can't talk.
Or 30 yards.
It could be. Who better to keep you company, seriously, than Jack Lemmon? There's nobody funnier or more endearing and relatable. And sometimes he even seems so lost, he could make you forget for a few minutes just how hopeless your situation is stuck on that island as he's trying to figure things out.
Look at that. Look how she moves. It's just like Jell-O on springs. Must have some sort of built-in motor or something. I tell you, it's a whole different sex.
What are you afraid of? Nobody's asking you to have a baby. This is just to get us out of town. Once we get the flower, we'll blow this whole set up.
Joe, this time I am not going to let you talk me into something that...
Extra, extra, 7th floor in North Side Garage. Feared bloody aftermath. Extra, extra.
You talked me into it. Let's go, Josephine. Not a girl, Geraldine.
Lemon was a big reason for me. That clinched this number one spot. But of course, it's those other films, as I mentioned, just so much good stuff. Another one who worked in a variety of genres as well. A lot of times he took different genres and added to them in some way. He did something that we hadn't seen before. The war movie in Stalag 17, Sunset Boulevard, the movies about movies, and Double Indemnity, I think, took film noir to another place as well. At least it did for me. So Wilder is my number one.
Yeah, that's good. It was probably my number six, seven, somewhere around there. Really gave him some consideration too.
Those are our top five desert island directors. And we do have to mention some honorable mentions, including I have to get to the announcement of the winner of the Film Spotting t-shirt. So Josh, you go first. Any others that got strong consideration?
Honorable mentions, yeah. The only other contemporary filmmakers who could compete with Wes Anderson for my affection right now would be Joel and Ethan Coen. So thought about trying to squeeze them on this list. I also thought about doing a little bit of a cheat by including Walt Disney as producer. But I mean, the number of titles he presided over, just some amazing stuff. And I would love to have some animation there, too. So that was really hard to leave off. Charlie Chaplin was another name. Some people would probably go Buster Keaton. It seems like you're always forced to choose between those two, even though it's not quite fair. But I would go with Charlie Chaplin. David Gordon Green in the interview mentioned John Ford. Thought about that, as I said. And then one more here, Fritz Lang, M, Metropolis. I recently caught up with Dr. Mabuse, The Gambler. I mean, these are all landmark movies. It would be really hard to give up.
Well, my three toughest omissions, there's six overall, but the big three you've already covered. They are Kubrick, Hitchcock, and the Coen brothers. For me, could have been number six or seven. That's the one that really threw off a lot of Film Spotting listeners. They were sure in that challenge that the Coen brothers would make my list.
I would have guessed that too, yeah.
I could easily have them on there in the place of the five I mentioned. I do love their work that much, and there's enough of their films. It's not as if they've only made five or six movies. So if you really are looking for something to keep you occupied and movies to challenge you and entertain you, the Coen brothers have that. I also, of course, considered Martin Scorsese. And more recently, you talked about having someone who's vital now, and I don't really have that on my list. I mean, Woody's still making movies, Herzog's still making movies, but otherwise I went with more of those canon type filmmakers. Paul Thomas Anderson and Steven Soderbergh would be the two.
Soderbergh is the one I thought you were
that I really thought
with.
Of. Yeah. And yes, so that's where a lot of Film Spotting listeners went. As I said, put out on Twitter and Facebook the challenge, predict my list, and see how you do. And a lot of listeners went with some variation of those. A lot of them mentioned Wilder, and some even got Hawks, some even got Herzog, and they got Woody Allen, but the list was rounded out with Soderbergh or PTA or the Coen brothers, and obviously I just went in a different direction. On Twitter, nobody got more than two right. On Facebook, nobody got more than three right, and there were three of those listeners, so I'll just share that real quick. Kevin Haar had Allen, Herzog, and Wilder, but also had David Lynch and Paul Thomas Anderson. Matt Bartosz had those same three, Allen, Herzog, and Wilder, but added Lynch, David Lynch, and Steven Soderbergh. And finally, Mike Esty had the Coens and Kurosawa with those other three. And so with those three tying, I put them in the film spotting hat, randomly picked out a winner, and it was Mike Esty. I believe Mike is in Seattle, longtime listener of the show and supporter of the show. Congratulations, Mike. You did well. We will send you your film spotting T-shirt.
Can I get a T-shirt too, by the way, if they're ready and available? I mean, it's great to be giving them out to listeners.
Three-year anniversary.
I can't wait.
You'll finally get the T-shirt. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
You know, Sam said this top five was going to be long. I told him it wouldn't. And
how
once again,
did you ever think it would not be long?
And I was wrong because I'm an idiot. Out in wide release this weekend, Draft Day, Kevin Costner as GM of the Cleveland Browns, and yet another movie that's all about, from what I can tell from the trailer, picking players by your gut and, you know, not using any kind of analytics whatsoever. But, you know, I won't get on that rant right now. Rio 2, the sequel to the 2011 animated musical comedy, and The Raid 2, Gareth Evans' follow-up to The Raid. Josh, have you seen The Raid?
I'm unfamiliar with these, yeah.
These action movies, a lot of people love them.
I know it.
And
yep.
We're missing out, apparently, so we need to catch up. Out in limited release in Chicago, I'll just list off some titles here real quick. Cheap Thrills, Cuban Fury, Dom Hemingway, The French Minister, On My Way, it's one from France with Catherine Deneuve, and Joe and Under the Skin. We heard from those filmmakers, David Gordon Green and Jonathan Glazer, earlier in the show. Next week on the show, we're going to review Joe from David Gordon Green, starring Ty Sheridan and Nicolas Cage, and we're going to share those top five lists of our favorite performances by non-professional actors. Should be a fun one.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week came from Chuck Reagan. More information is at chuckreaganmusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. It's good to be back. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
What a massacre theater to come back to.
Holy moly. And you know what's really funny? Before I could find the scene, I was reading it, and I was sure, I was doing it the whole time in my head, as if Dale was Danny McBride. Because
oh, no,
I could totally
no.
hear Danny McBride doing the, you know, or a fucking anal
well,
beat.
Well, it, you thought that
Seth
because
Rogen.
It's more vulgar.
Exactly.
But no,
I heard him the whole
part,
time.
This first part is so McBride.
It belongs to me. That's Dale. That is Danny McBride, and not Rogen at all. So who do you want?